Good morning, everybody. We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Thursday, April 13, 2017, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor v. Arnold Stoning, docket sent 2016-95M. Present are myself, Acting Chairman Althing, Commissioner Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Cohen. Ordinarily, we start with an overview from counsel. Today, because of oppressive time for other commission business after this meeting, we're going to dispense with an overview by Ruben Mukherjee, who we all compliment. An excellent memorandum on this, which has helped everybody at this table. So, Ruben, I'm sorry we're not going to hear your excellent presentation, but we need to move this meeting along. I will briefly explain, for folks who haven't obviously had a chance to see the record, that we're going to talk about the judge's refusal to find an unwarrantable failure today. The secretary asserts the violation was an unwarrantable failure as a matter of law because the operator knew about the loader's obvious defects for a significant period of time and did nothing to abate it, and that there were no unusual mitigating circumstances. Secretary asserts the judge erred by treating the fact that only a handful of people were exposed to the hazard as a mitigating factor with respect to degree of danger for the unwarrantable failure analysis. The secretary alleges the judge did not appear to have treated the fact that Arnold Stone had not previously received a citation for the defect as a mitigating factor, but if she did, it would be error. And that for all the reasons set out in the brief on those points, the judge's finding that it was a high negligence rather than reckless disregard does not change the fact that it should be considered an unwarrantable failure. So we're talking about the judge's refusal to find an unwarrantable failure. She found the citation for gravity and negligence purposes the same as the secretary cited, except she changed reckless disregard to high negligence. And with that, Commissioner Jordan will begin.
Thank you, Chairman. I would say that I would reverse the judge's finding of no unwarrantable failure, and I would remand it for a reassessment of the penalty. In my mind, that the judge erred, an aspect of the decision that stands out to me is the fact that the judge seemed to consider it almost like a mitigating factor that the site supervisor never told the higher up, I forget Mr. Arnold's exact position.
Mine owner,
that he was not informed about the defective condition in the end loader. Now, in terms of the negligence under the Mine Act, the fact that the site supervisor, Mr. Sorrells, knew about this condition actually for quite some time. In one regard, I think it was about 18 months. And in fact, the miners had learned to adjust their positions around it, that the machine would lurch forward because the safety locks were not repaired that would prevent that. And if somebody accidentally touched the controls, in getting in or out of the machine, it could lurch forward and injure people. You know, it strikes me, and the penalty that was proposed by the secretary, which was about 60-something thousand, was considerably reduced by the judge in the end to something in the nature of about $10,000, I believe. And I believe that this error infected that assessment of the penalty, and the error, in my mind, it's kind of strange because, you know, the fact that the site foreman never reported it, I think nothing was ever recorded in a book and never reported it to the person that could fix it. You know, in a lot of cases we get, that could be the basis for a whole separate citation under the Act. You know, and here, so it's I think, a little odd and a wrong way to look at things that one should focus on Mr. Arnold's maybe lack of direct knowledge as a way to lead to a reduction of penalties. So I believe that this violation that is before us has the attributes of an unwarrantable failure. I don't even think you need to go through a checklist of factors. I mean, when you have a hazardous condition allowed to exist, the supervisor on the site knew of its existence, did not take steps to correct it, knowingly really allowed it to exist, that the secretary's ability to designate that kind of violation as unwarrantable, and therefore to trigger the specific enforcement mechanisms that come into play in unwarrantable with the issuance of closure orders and getting on unwarrantable chain, to me this is more than present here in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Juba, I do want to thank you very much for your very thoughtful memo and your astute analysis of this case. I found that very helpful, and I agree with it generally. And I also am going to agree in part with Commissioner Jordan, but disagree in part. Judging is both an art and a science. Some things, figuring out what's a just outcome, the apportionment of fault, just determining who to believe. Those are artistic endeavors that rely on the judge's skill and insights. But some judicial functions are more scientific, and when you have the elements before you as a judge in certain quantities, it's very much like chemistry. You anticipate a certain outcome, and that's the outcome that should be produced, and if that outcome isn't reached, you've done something wrong. Here, I hate to fault the judge too much. I think that in trying to carry out her function as the person responsible overall for the disposition of this case, she struck a balance and disregarded certain of her own findings in making an unwarrantable failure determination. I would specifically and directly agree with Commissioner Jordan that when you have a condition that is found by the judge to be S&S, found by the judge to have existed at least intermittently for 18 months, found by the judge to have existed in that intermittent inoperable condition for that period of time with the knowledge of a site supervisor whose responsibility is imputable to the operator, that has to be an unwarrantable failure, because those are the facts as we are presented to them. The operator didn't contest these, did not seek to challenge any of these findings. That's what we have. However, looking at this, these Bobcats, they're not large machines if you've ever been around them or worked around them. Falling from one would not be a serious problem unless it were to continue running, and even if it were to continue running, I don't know if it was demonstrated in this case by the record that it could injure the operator. And it seemed at the time that there may have been nobody to one other person around for much of the time that this was the condition. Furthermore, while I'm often astonished by operators who seem to insist that the machine was functioning perfectly until the MSHA inspector showed up and then the defect manifested itself right at that time, I'm a believer in Murphy's Law, but that seems to happen a lot. The flip side here is that this machine was inspected several times by MSHA during the relevant time period and was never found to have had a defect, which makes one question the severity of the problem and the frequency. I think we've all experienced things where you think, well, this is a situation where I think something happened, but you can't duplicate it. And you're afraid to call the repairman because you know as soon as the repairman shows up, it's never going to have a problem in his presence. So you have to question this. Furthermore, the operator had testimony that they put on that, and perhaps there's some scapegoating here, and we take, as we receive them, the judge's credibility determinations, but there was some testimony that the operator believes that the machine operators of this particular equipment should have reported it, did not report it, and there was a disciplinary action taken against one of them for failure to do so. That was the testimony of the operator. The judge did not find that compelling or credible, and it's not before us, and it's not subject to our debate. But all of this gets us back to the art part, and that's the assessment of the penalty. You know, the secretary has a more scientific approach how to come up with it over in Arlington. They have tables, they have points, they make an assessment, but the law gives the judge the responsibility to assess the penalty. Using the criteria in the act, the statutory criteria, and the judge very pointedly and specifically did so in this case. And those factors, which do not include whether it is an unwarrantable failure or not, included the negligence level that she found in this case, which was not challenged by the secretary. And the other factors taken into account, including the size of the operation and the penalty history, which she found to be low, the degree of danger, which she didn't find to be especially high, and I would have to agree with her on that. Taking all of that into account, I would just affirm her on the penalty amount that she found in this case. I think it's within her province to apply those statutory criteria, and I don't see any fault in the way she's done that. There's precedent in the commission. I provided my colleagues with a case that my counsel found for me, a Cypress Emerald case, that showed that even if the nature of the violation changes, in this Cypress Emerald case, the unwarrantable failures were added sua sponte by the judge improperly and were deleted, but the other findings were sufficient to support the penalty, and I think that's precedent for just supporting the judge's penalty determination in the case, and that's what I would do here. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Commissioner Cohen.
Thank you. And I want to thank Drupal also for the memo. My bottom line is that I would reverse the judge, find it to be an unwarrantable failure, and remand for reassessment of the penalty. But I come at this in a somewhat different way from my colleagues. I want to address first the secretary's first argument, which was that the operator, if the operator knows that an obvious S&S violation exists and has known this for a significant period of time, and if there's any real risk to safety, then it should be deemed unwarrantable unless there are significant mitigating factors. The secretary uses the phrase as a matter of law, but essentially the secretary is arguing for the creation of a presumption. If he can prove 3.5 of the 7 factors which the commission has recognized in Manalapan Mining, IO Coal, and other cases, plus S&S, then the violation is presumptively unwarrantable, and the burden shifts to the operator to prove significant mitigating factors, which the secretary did not define for us. And when I say 3.5 of the factors, I'm referring to 1, knowledge, 2, obviousness, 3, duration, plus at least a little danger. That's the half factor. Because it does not have to be significant danger in the secretary's formulation. The secretary asserts that the factor of notice is established by virtue of knowledge, obviousness, and duration, and that the factors of extensiveness and efforts to abate do not really have to be considered at all. I don't think that the secretary's attempt to establish a new presumption is at all helpful. We have a well-established and quite serviceable approach. The judge looks at 7 factors. He or she does not have to give them equal weight. Indeed, the judge is free to determine that in the particular circumstances of the case, 1 or more of the factors may be irrelevant. The commission rightly has concluded that consideration of all 7 factors serves 2 very important functions. First, it focuses the attention of the parties and the judge on those factors which may be relevant to a determination of unwarrantable failure. Second, it provides a full basis for the commission to fulfill its review function if the ALJ's decision is appealed. The secretary's proposal would add a new level of analysis. The secretary would be able to prove unwarrantable through the traditional method of analysis, or if he failed, and if the violation was S&S, he could take a shortened approach to his burden of proof and place a rebuttal obligation on the operator. I think that this would greatly complicate analysis of unwarrantable failure issues, with no gain in clarity or accuracy. It's not clear whether the Secretary is arguing for deference. He mentions deference in two sentences of one paragraph in the section of his brief which discusses legal standards, and then does not mention deference again when arguing for the proposed presumption, which encompasses four pages of text. I totally reject the applicability of deference here. This is an after-the-hearing, convenient litigating position. There's nothing to show here that it is the fair and considered judgment of the Secretary, which is what is required for our deference under the our methodology of granting deference, considering deference. Moreover, the fact, well, the Secretary in the balance of his brief very ably sets forth several persuasive arguments based on analysis of the Commission's seven Manalapan mining IOCOL factors. And this analysis demonstrates that the judge's deletion of the unwarrantable failure designation was erroneous. Thus, the overall presentation by the Secretary illustrates why the proposed presumption is unnecessary. Now, in terms of the judge's unwarrantable failure finding, first, I think that the judge erred in treating the factor of Arnold Stone's efforts to abate the condition as mitigating rather than aggravating. The judge found that the testimony of Mike Arnold, that he was unaware of the defect in the loader, was credible. That conclusion has not been challenged by the Secretary. But then the judge went on to find that Mike Arnold's personal ignorance of the violation, together with Dennis Sorrell's lack of authority to fix the problem, constituted a major mitigating factor. Arnold only visited the site a couple of times a month. Sorrells was the man in charge at the mine. Arnold testified that Sorrells was his eyes and ears. But Sorrells did not have the authority to order repairs. The Secretary properly characterizes this arrangement as corporate balkanization and properly argues that it should not be rewarded by the Commission. Since he knew of the defect, even if he lacked authority to authorize repairs, Sorrell clearly had responsibility to deactivate the loader and notify Arnold of the problem. He did not do the former, and the judge found that he did not do the latter either. And he did nothing over a long period of time. At most, he told miners outside the loader to try to keep away from it. Clearly, the total lack of effort on the part of Arnold Stone to remediate a violation, which the judge determined to be S&S, constitutes a greatly aggravating circumstance in terms of unwarrantable failure. Second, I agree with the Secretary that the judge erred in determining that the factors of extensiveness and danger were mitigating because of the small size of the mine. Regarding extensiveness, as my counsel Carter has taught me, there are a number of ways to consider extent, and the number of miners is only one of them. The loader was used every day by miners. At least in the last few months before the MSHA inspection, the defect, a complete failure of the safety switch, was constant rather than intermittent. The driver got in and out of the loader frequently, each time exposing himself to danger. The factor of extensiveness seen in this light is not mitigating. This is not at all a situation similar to Dawes rigging, which is what the judge found. As for the factor of dangerousness, the judge found the violation to be S&S, which requires a reasonable likelihood of serious injury to a miner. I don't think that it matters that the danger was only to one or two miners at a time, given that this defect existed over a period of 18 months. The danger of serious injury to miners over a period of 18 months as a result of this violation is not a mitigating circumstance. Third is the issue of being on notice that greater efforts were necessary. The triggering of this factor is not limited to action by MSHA, as the Secretary points out. Here the violation was obvious, was known to Arnold Stone's on-site supervisor, and lasted for a long time before the MSHA inspection. There's really no question but that the operator was aware that greater efforts at compliance were necessary. I don't see anything mitigating here. And so I do not see any need to remand the unwarrantable failure issue to the judge for further consideration. Unlike the CAM mining case, where Commissioner Young and I dissented from a commission decision which found unwarrantable failure as a matter of law, although the judge had made no findings on this issue. Here, if it were remanded on the unwarrantable failure issue, there would be essentially nothing for the judge to weigh on remand. Hence, I think in this case, the commission can and should make a finding of unwarrantable failure. This leaves the issue of the penalty. The judge reduced the proposed penalty of $63,000 to $10,000. I understand that some of my colleagues, well, Commissioner Young, I thought I was going to go second, so I didn't.
Sorry, did I get it out of order?
Makes for more of a dialogue.
I'm loving what you're saying anyways.
Oh, I'm sure you are. Commissioner Young, and I understand Acting Chairman Alton also, would simply affirm the $10,000 penalty without remand. I would disagree with that. In reducing the penalty, the judge cited a number of Section 110I factors, including that Arnold Stone is a family-operated business with little history of violations. Moreover, the operator had recently emerged from bankruptcy and was paying off debts according to the bankruptcy plan. The judge accepted the testimony that paying a fine as high as $63,000 would be a hardship. All of this supports a significant reduction of the penalty from the Secretary's proposed assessment, and I would have no objection to a significant reduction of the penalty here based on those factors. But if the Commission reinstates the unwarrantable failure designation, this involves, I think, a very significant change in how the operator's negligence is viewed in this case. This is not just a matter of assigning categories taken from the Part 100 regulations, especially where the Secretary did not appeal the judge's reduction of the negligence from the category of reckless disregard to the category of high negligence. Fundamentally, we're dealing with a much higher level of responsibility than the judge found. The judge accepted Arnold Stone's structure of the ultimate authority being kept in ignorance and the person on site not having the authority to fix the problem. I think that shows a much higher real level of negligence than what the judge found. And I think that we should remand the case to give her, the judge, an opportunity to reconsider the penalty in that light. I don't think it's our function. I don't think we can say, well, the judge considered everything that was relevant if we make the findings that three commissioners now have spoken of making. Thus, if we don't remand it, we're essentially making the penalty here and not giving the judge the opportunity to assess the penalty, which is the function of judges, not us. Our function is to review assessments. So I would remand for reassessment.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Yes, I'm fortunately able to go last and therefore get the benefit of all the good discussion by my friends.
You're the acting chairman?
Yeah, I'm acting chairman. God knows how long that will last. Going last and a tiny pay increase are the only benefits. First, I'll agree with Commissioner Cohen, everything he said on the attempt to create a presumption here. I think he was dead on it. It needn't be repeated. And I'm also going to agree that we should simply reverse the judge and find an unwarrantable failure. I do so essentially because the judge's decision creates a certain amount of one of my favorite phrases, cognitive dissonance in my mind, in that she finds gravity in her penalty assessment. She found it's S&S and then found gravity to be, as the Secretary cited, which is essentially reasonably likely to result in permanently disabling injuries. And so I think her reliance for reducing the degree of danger on the basis of two minors involved where she's found reasonable likelihood of permanently disabling injuries is creates some cognitive dissonance. Also, for all the reasons that you folks have discussed, knowledge and so forth, the period of time, I would reverse and find an unwarrantable failure. Therefore, I'll turn to the penalty. I will agree with Commissioner Young on just allowing the penalty to stay where it is. And in discussing that, I just want to briefly touch upon what is a continuing problem for me with the way the Secretary is going about assessing penalties these days. Had the Secretary, this was specially assessed. The Secretary proposed for public comment, took public comment, and then promulgated Part 100 with a specific set of point system so that there could be regularity in the assessment of penalties. Then, of course, the Secretary also allowed for special assessments in certain circumstances without defining what those circumstances would be. Had the Secretary used the Part 100 penalty points here, the assessment would have been $11,307. Rather than assessing the regular points, they decided to specially assess, and then through their magic system came up with $63,000. And looking at their narrative on a special assessment, it appears the reason they have sixfold increased the regular penalty here is that they found that the conduct violated the rules to live by. Fair enough. Except the rules to live by are not mandatory safety standards, and I've been increasingly perplexed the Secretary treating them like they are mandatory safety standards through such things as a sixfold increase in penalty if you don't abide by an informal instruction of MSHA. If you're going to assess a sixfold increase in penalties based upon particular conduct that is not a mandatory standard, not required by a mandatory standard, then you should propose that as a mandatory standard so operators have fair notice of what they're going to get. The reasons they're going to get especially high penalties. I notice here that the Secretary did not argue that the judge didn't explain a substantial deviation from the proposed penalty. Our case law clearly says she had to have explained the deviation, and she didn't say anything about it, but they haven't raised it on appeal to us. And I think that may well be because they know that this special assessment system they have now is inconsistent with our judges having to explain a substantial deviation. If it is a regular system they're explaining the deviation from, all right. But when it's a magic number they've come up with through their internal calculations, I don't see why our judges should give any deference at all to a special assessment. And so I think I'd like to specifically hold that where there's a special assessment, judges need not explain a substantial deviation. Now, turning to this specific case, although we don't use the penalty system and wouldn't use the penalty system, decry the use of the penalty system by us or by our judges, had this penalty been assessed the way the judge found it, it would have been a $3,000 penalty because of the point reduction from going reckless disregard to high negligence. However, the judge found on I think, well-spoken grounds, the penalty should be $10,000. And Commissioner Young helped provided a similar Cypress Emerald case where, if I may quote, it involved an unwarrantable failure where the judge had changed a citation to make two citations unwarrantable failures. We said, quote, under this reasoning, the judge erred in modifying the above citations to allege unwarrantable failure violations. Accordingly, we reversed the judge's modification of the two April citations. Nonetheless, our holding does not cause us to disturb the judge's penalty assessments for these two citations. See a citation. In reviewing a judge's penalty assessment, the commission must determine whether the penalty is supported by substantial evidence and is consistent with the statutory penalty criteria. While a judge's assessment of a penalty is an exercise of discretion, assessments lacking record support, infected by plain error, or otherwise constituting abuse of discretion are not immune from reversal. We conclude that the judge's finding that the two violations were a result of negligence, Emerald's high negligence, are supported by substantial evidence. And went on and affirmed the penalty, despite the fact that they had knocked out two unwarrantable failures. Now, we're reinstating an unwarrantable failure, but the judge's decision on the penalty discussed all the criteria, included the citation as being reasonably likely to create permanently disabling, and high negligence. And I appreciate Judge Cohen's remarks about this is some sort of reckless high negligence or high negligence plus. But I think the judge acted within her discretion here in assessing the penalty criteria. And I don't think it's our what we're saying is, since we're not happy with the penalty, but the judge looked at the penalty criteria. It's her decision. She didn't abuse her discretion. Therefore, I wouldn't change the penalty. I just simply reverse the case, reverse it, find an unwarrantable failure, and end the case. We're open.
Sure. Couple of points. I don't think we should refer to the special assessment procedure as a magic system. There are bases that they have articulated as to when they will do special assessments, they being the secretary, when the secretary will do special assessments and how the point system changes. I think that's all set out in there. Maybe it hasn't gone notice and comment hearing, but it's not magic.
But what I've referred to there is not particularly this case, but a prior case we've had where, and it's certainly not because they have a formula for special assessments.
It's not a magic system.
They have a formula, but it doesn't matter why they've specially assessed. They apply the same formula regardless why they specially assessed. So we've had a case recently, and I guess it's on remand now, but back before us now, where the secretary's reason for specially assessing had nothing to do with gravity or negligence, and yet they made substantial increases in gravity and negligence points in order to specially assess it. That's not this case, but that's another case. So once they decide to specially assess, whatever the reason, they put it into a canned formula that greatly increases the penalty. Okay.
Well,
but then explain, and plus I am concerned about using rules to live by to create six-fold increases in penalties without ever having promulgated the rules to live by. So this allows the government to do an informal statement of a standard and then say, and if you violate that standard, not the mandatory standard, but the standard we've done informally, you will pay six times the amount. I think that's wrong.
Well, I disagree that this thing went up six times because it happened to fall into the category of rules to live by.
Why didn't it do that?
Why? It stated in the narrative findings for a special assessment.
And the Native Fair Assessment said it violated the rules to live by.
It says in the special, it mentions, yeah, the cited standard is cited as a rules to live by standard. And then it goes on to say, the negligence of the operator was considered to be reckless disregard. The defective lockout on the skid steer loader had been recorded and reported to the mine operator several times over the past 3 years. The operator was aware of the existing hazard, but still instructed the miner to operate the equipment. The miner was told that production is priority one. Management clearly placed production requirements first ahead of employee safety. What that's based on is evidence that the secretary was relying on that people reported to Mike Arnold, the owner, that this thing is defective and that Arnold's response was, operate it anyway, it's too expensive to fix. Now,
is that Arnold or Sorrells?
Arnold.
But the judge didn't credit that.
I know that, but that's what, if you look at that fact and you accept that fact, then I think you can justify a six-fold increase in the penalty. That's outrageous if it happened. So, but the judge, as you say, did not find it. So the judge brought it way down. But you don't criticize the six-fold increase in the way that you're doing. The six-fold increase makes some sense if you accepted the findings.
But the six-fold increase isn't based upon that particular, it's based upon a canned formula they put points into once they decide to specially assess.
And the reason for it is stated here.
No, but the reason for the increase is not stated. They don't say we're changing this to 60,000 because it's reckless disregard. They change this because we've added 10 penalty points for seriousness of injury. That drove it up 20,000. They add points for unwarrantable failure points. Their point system doesn't reflect the reason they're specially assessing it. In other words, there's a disconnect between the reason they specially assess and the number they apply to the special assessment. Complete disconnect.
No.
Well, anyway.
But,
Just a couple things. First of all, I want to join the chairman in endorsing what Commissioner Cohen had to say about the presumption. The second thing, on the special assessment, I'm not sure I completely agree with the chairman, and I might agree a little more with Commissioner Cohen on some aspects of it. And in particular, the reason you have rules to live by is because the points of emphasis, the dangers that confront minors, they may change over time. When MSHA notices things, they put a special emphasis on certain violations and certain practices and conditions. I happen to think that's a good thing.
Well, I think that's a good thing.
Increasing the penalty because of that is not an out of bounds thing. At the same time, Mr. Cohen, I think that there is some opacity in the calculation of special assessments, and there does seem to be sometimes a disconnect in how MSHA reaches a result in terms of the proportionality and how they get there. I think there's some overcharging that happens, and I'm concerned about that too. But all of that doesn't affect, in the end, the calculation of the penalty by the judge. And the fact is that high negligence is the law of the case here. The secretary has not challenged that. So whatever negligence level is asserted here, it's not going to be any higher than high negligence. It's not going back to reckless disregard. And for that reason, those are the factors the judge considered. They're the statutory factors. So that's just a professional disagreement you and I have on that.
The statutory factors do not include, it says negligence. It does not provide for the categorization that the secretary made of high, low, moderate, high, reckless disregard. And I don't think that we are bound or should be bound by those categorizations. And the fact that the secretary did not choose to appeal the reduction from reckless disregard to high doesn't change the fact that our assessment of negligence is greater than the assessment that the judge made. And that's why I think it needs to be reassessed. I think that there's that you can get into some overcharging too. And I tried to address that when I said that I thought that the judge, made a significant reduction here and that was entirely proper. But the way that the point system works is that as you get to the upper ranges of the points, the penalty kind of goes dramatically higher. It's not a straight line.
Linear, yeah.
It's not linear in terms. It kind of, I don't know, there's a term for that.
Yeah, there's a term. Yeah.
And that's the way the
exponential.
Points. Exponential.
Exponential.
Yeah. And that's the way their point system is structured. And so they.
But Bob, you're really saying this actually is not only reckless disregard, it's reckless disregard. And they didn't challenge that.
I didn't take him saying that.
Well, no, you said it was gross, spectacularly bad. I mean, I thought that's what
I think. No, I said it's worse than what the judge found. It's not as bad as what the secretary charged. The secretary's charge was based on the evidence that the judge rejected that Mike Arnold personally knew and said, go operate it, it's too damn expensive to fix. The judge didn't buy that. And that hasn't been challenged. And she made credibility findings, and that's the finding. That's what we have.
So I understand you're rejecting the pigeonhole, and you're saying reckless disregard is one pigeonhole, high negligence is another pigeonhole, and you think it's in between the pigeonholes.
I think there's a reasonable middle ground where you say, look, negligence, as we've held, is a holistic concept that the judge has to take into account. My feeling is that she did that when she applied the statutory criteria. She considered these things. I understand your disagreement because you feel like she misapprehended some of the factors that go into that holistic determination. I just believe in this case that she assessed the penalty that she thought was appropriate, and that it wasn't like she was easy on the operator in this case. I think that in general, she took a pretty hard line with this violation, given what it was.
I'd like to comment, since my colleagues have all commented on the Secretary's discussion of their approach to unwarrantable and suggesting that there not necessarily be a recitation analysis of all the factors that the Commission has set out. I actually think, to me, it's straightforward. It's just kind of common sense. They say that they would be designated as unwarrantable. I'm reading from the Truba's memo here, so I think it sets it out, that if it's S&S known, longstanding, obvious, does not involve unusual mitigating circumstances. I mean, frankly, if an inspector came upon a scene where there was a longstanding, obvious hazardous violation, I would expect him to designate it as unwarrantable. I mean, that's what the act is there for. So this is nothing, you know, surprising or shocking. And to me, I think this is maybe a little bit of a, I don't know if the term pushback is there, but I've been experienced the same thing. To sort of come out and say, no, when I hear my colleagues doing the factors, the, you know, there's only, this is only 3.5 of the factors. We need all the 7 factors. I'm finding it to be very kind of contorting the analysis of unwarrantable. For instance, in this case, the question of whether they were previously cited by MSHA, you know, that was kind of, you know, lack of, I forget how we've stated our factor, you know, prior notice that your efforts are not good enough. So I find the judge's decision now, you know, a lot of them, you know, maybe the clerks feel, you know, that are writing, they have to do it. So there's this mechanical, almost mechanical discussion, you know, of each factor. And it starts to look a little nutty, you know, because here we have a situation. So they're actually a note in the decision like, well, it's true, you know, they've never been cited before, so they never really had prior notice that their efforts were not good enough. When, as my colleague, you know, Commissioner Cohen has pointed out, there was actually evidence, not credited by the judge, but, you know, the situation here is everybody knew this piece of equipment was not working properly, and they more or less decided they were not going to fix it. And it's a little, it starts to make it, I read this and I read a judge and a decision kind of even contemplating, should that be, you know, kind of mitigating? They never were cited by MSHA. And so I just would ask my colleagues, I mean, to the extent you envision a decision which is unanimous, at least in the unwarrantable, going off to a discussion about the Secretary's presumption, it's going to get a little more complicated decision, because I'm not going to be, I don't think, joining the flavor and the fervor of what I hear at this table of the indignation.
I don't think we need to discuss, but Bob may feel that's very important. But, you know, in response to what you said, though,
I wouldn't think it is warrants more than a footnote.
That's what I was thinking. I mean,
a footnote.
I just like the way you expressed it.
Yeah, you didn't.
But I don't think we need more than a footnote.
I didn't.
On it.
But that,
well, what I was going to say, Mary Lou, though, is this is a point I think we privately discussed this before, because as my attorney advisor has advised me, the judges actually read our decisions and they pay attention to them, and we have said in prior decisions we've reversed judges sometimes for not mechanically going down.
Well, not me. I probably dissented.
No, you didn't.
Or maybe I've had to go, you know.
Because actually, I remember one of my early cases where I don't think I dissented. I think I wrote a footnote saying I disagreed with it. And this would, why don't we give them a checklist, a form they can fill out, you know, with the 7 factors, and they can write, you know, if we're going to do that. I think when it's irrelevant, it doesn't need to be discussed. And therefore, I don't think the absence of a discussion of irrelevant factors should be reason. But I think we've got some decisions which tend to indicate discuss them all, relevant
right,
or not.
To be safe, yeah. And
so,
it's a little crazy.
If we've said that, I think we should unsay it.
Let me speak to that, because I think I disagree. I know I disagree with Commissioner Jordan on this. I'm not sure how much I disagree with you, because I'm not sure what you mean about not discussing it. I think that the seven factors have a purpose of focusing the party's attention and the judge's attention on what is relevant to unwarrantable failure, and that the decision should indicate that the judge has given consideration to each of the seven factors. Now, if one of those factors, or two or three of the factors, is irrelevant, the judge says, this factor is irrelevant because, and explains why it's irrelevant, and then that's fine.
But what I'm saying, Bob, is that suppose the judge doesn't do that, but when we look at the decision, it clearly is irrelevant, but the judge hasn't said that's irrelevant. We shouldn't, in my mind, be reversing to send it back for the judge to say it's irrelevant.
I don't think we are. I don't think I vote to reverse in those situations.
Well,
I would prefer it if the judge said it. You know, if the judge
that's
doesn't
all,
say
that's
it,
all
then
I'm
it's
saying.
Probably harmless
that's,
error.
That's all I'm saying is that the failure to mechanically go down doesn't indicate automatically reversal.
No, no. And I have affirmed.
I'm not accusing it.
No,
not
no, I know. But I'm just saying, okay, I shouldn't put it that way. Yeah, I agree that, at least in my mind, I'm going to look at the seven factors. If the judge doesn't touch on one and it's not important, that's not going to bother me particularly.
That's all I'm saying.
The bristling I have is this. And if you have a case, as this case, where the secretary says, the secretary's interpretation of this provision is thus, in my opinion, in this case, it's a correct interpretation of the law, but that's because, as the secretary explains in his brief, that's what the law is as we've explained it. Not because the secretary says it. It's correct not because we must agree with the secretary. It's correct because this is what we've held. So if you look at it, to me, I'm going to say, yeah, let's have a footnote say to the extent they're suggesting that there's some presumption. There's not, but it's a correct interpretation of the law, because if you have a case, you can have certain elements that are so powerful that there's nothing that you can present to overcome it. And you know, if you have as Commissioner Jordan said, the conditions present in this case, you know, the other factors, you start piling things up. It's not math. It's not weight and measures. It's you know, this is the kind of thing the law was supposed to address. And I would agree with you on that. Holistic.
I agree. Any one factor could put it in a vulnerable almost. I mean, if you have been told a case unlike this, but MSHA has told you many times about something, and they come upon the site and it hasn't been dealt with, it may not even be a dangerous condition. I would remind my unwarrantable doesn't need to be SNS. Section 104D2 specifically eliminates the SNS reference. But it has it that, you know, you've already been charged with something unwarrantable and they return within a certain amount of times. So, you know, to me, if the secretary didn't charge that operator as unwarrantable, I think they would be remiss. So I don't get troubled with, I mean, because any one factor could almost be extreme.
And
know,
if the
strong.
Judge explained it that way and said, this one factor is so strong and so compelling, I'm not going to consider the other factors because nothing would change the position, that you can't ignore the law and, you know, give a gesture to the secretary when the secretary says you have to enforce it, you have to make sure this condition doesn't exist. So I would agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll make one note that is that in the secretary's brief, they talk about wasn't a mitigating factor, and there tends to be an attempt almost to the burden of proof is always on the secretary to prove the unwarrantable failure. So it's not the burden on, as Commissioner Cohen pointed out, to prove mitigating factors. So, but if I think we all agree, look at the seven factors. If one's irrelevant, then that doesn't play a role because it's irrelevant by definition.
Right.
Should be mentioned, I agree. This is irrelevant. If the judge doesn't mention it, we don't reverse just to make her say it's irrelevant. Are we set with the decision in this case, though? We're trying to move this along.
I think so.
Ruby, do you understand the decision? Well, write as good a decision as you did a memo, and we're home free.
Yeah, I forgot to thank you, Drooper, also, because I started out the discussion, so, but I meant to thank you for the memo. It's helpful.
And so the result would probably be to affirm the 10,000.
Affirm the 10,000, yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. nothing else, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The meeting is adjourned.